and telling her stories. It was like showing her his unclean underwear. She tried to see him through Auntie Uju's eyes, a man of wonders, a man of worldly excitements. But she could not. She recognized the lightness of being, the joyfulness that Auntie Uju had on weekdays. It was how she felt when she was looking forward to seeing Obinze after school. But it seemed wrong, a waste, that Auntie Uju should feel this for the general. Auntie Uju's ex-boyfriend, Olujimi, was different, nice-looking and smooth-voiced. He glistened with a quiet polish. They had been together for most of university, and when you saw them, you saw why they were together. "I outgrew him," Auntie Uju said. "Don't you outgrow and move on to something better?" Ifemelu asked, and Auntie Uju laughed, as though it was really a joke. On the day of the coup, a close friend of the general's called Auntie Uju to ask if she was with him. There was tension. Some army officers had already been arrested. Auntie Uju was not with the general, did not know where he was. And she paced upstairs, and then downstairs, worried, making phone calls that yielded nothing. Soon she began to heave, struggling to breathe. Her panic had turned into an asthma attack. She was gasping, shaking, piercing her arm with a needle, trying to inject herself with medicine, drops of blood staining the bedcovers, until Ifemelu ran down the street to bang on the door of a neighbor whose sister was also a doctor. Finally, the general called to say that he was fine. The coup had failed, and all was well with the head of state. Auntie Uju's trembling stopped. On a Muslim holiday, one of those two-day holidays when non-Muslims in Lagos said, "Happy Salah," to whoever they assumed to be a Muslim, often gatemen from the north, and MTA showed footage after footage of men slaughtering rams, the general promised to visit. It would be the first time he spent a public holiday with Auntie Uju. She was in the kitchen the entire morning, supervising Chikodili, singing loudly from time to time, being a little too familiar with Chikodili, a little too quick to laugh with her. Finally, the cooking done, and the house smelling of spices and sauces, Auntie Uju went upstairs to shower. "Ifim, please come and help me trim my hair, down there. Oga says it disturbs him," Auntie Uju said, laughing, and then lay on her back, legs spread and held high, an old gossip magazine beneath her, while Ifemelu worked with a shaving stick. Ifemelu had finished, and Auntie Uju was coating an exfoliating mask on her face, when the general called to say he could no longer come. Auntie Uju, her face ghoulish, covered in chalk-white paste except for the circles of skin around her eyes, hung up and walked into the kitchen and began to put the food in plastic containers for the freezer. Chikodile looked on in confusion. Auntie Uju worked feverishly, jerking the freezer compartment, slamming the cupboard, and as she pushed back the pot of jollof rice, the pot of egusi soup fell off the cooker. Auntie Uju stared at the yellowish-green sauce, spreading across the kitchen floor as though she did not know how it had happened. She turned to Chikodili and screamed, "Why are you looking like a mumu? Come on, clean it up!" Ifemelu was watching from the kitchen entrance. "Auntie, the person you should be shouting at is the general." Auntie Uju stopped, her eyes bulging and enraged. "Is it me you are talking to like that? Am I your age mate?" Auntie Uju charged at her. Ifemelu had not expected Auntie Uju to hit her, yet when the slap landed on the side of her face, making a sound that seemed to her to come from far away, finger-shaped welts rising on her cheek, she was not surprised. They stared at each other. Auntie Uju opened her mouth, as though to say something, and then she closed it, and turned and walked upstairs, both of them aware that something between them was now different. Auntie Uju did not come downstairs until evening, when Adesua and Uche came to visit. She called them "my friends in quotes." "I'm going to the salon with my friends in quotes," she would say, a wan laughter in her eyes. She knew they were her friends only because she was the general's mistress, but they amused her. They visited her insistently, comparing notes on shopping and travel, asking her to go to parties with them. It was strange what she knew and did not know about them, she once told Ifemelu. She knew that Adesua owned land in Abuja, given to her when she dated the head of state, and that a famously wealthy Hausa man had bought Uche's boutique in Surulere. But she did not know how many siblings either of them had, or where their parents lived, or whether they had gone to university. Chikodili let them in. They wore embroidered caftans and spicy perfume, their Chinese weaves hanging down to their backs, their conversations lined with a hard-edged worldliness, their laughter short and scornful.
I told him he must buy it in my Nemo. Ah, I knew he would not bring the money unless I said somebody was sick. No, now, he doesn't know I opened the account.
They were going to a Salar party in Victoria Island, and had come to take Auntie Uju.
I don't feel like going, Auntie Uju told them, while Chikodili served orange juice, a carton on a tray, two glasses placed beside it.
Why now?
Uche asked.
Serious big men are coming, Adesua said. You never know if you will meet somebody.
I don't want to meet anybody, Auntie Uju said.
And there was quiet, as though each of them had to catch their breath. Auntie Uju's words, a gale that tore through their assumptions. She was supposed to want to meet men, to keep her eyes open. She was supposed to see the general as an option that could be bettered. Finally, one of them, Adesua or Uche, said,
This your orange juice is the cheap brandu. You don't buy just juice anymore.
A lukewarm joke, but they laughed to ease the moment away. After they left, Auntie Uju came over to the dining table where Ifemelu sat reading.
Ifem, I don't know what got into me. Ndo.
She held Ifemelu's wrist, then ran her hand almost meditatively over the embossed title of Ifemelu's Sidney Sheldon novel.
I must be mad. He has a beer belly, handracular teeth, and a wife and children, and he's old.
For the first time, Ifemelu felt older than Auntie Uju, wiser and stronger than Auntie Uju, and she wished that she could wrest Auntie Uju away, shake her into a clear-eyed self who would not lay her hopes on the general, slaving and shaving for him, always eager to fade his flaws. It was not as it should be. Ifemelu felt a small gratification to hear later Auntie Uju shouting on the phone.
Nonsense! You knew you were going to Abuja from the beginning, so why let me waste my time preparing for you?
The cake a driver delivered the next morning with, I'm sorry, my love, written on it in blue frosting, had a bitter aftertaste, but Auntie Uju kept it in the freezer for months. Auntie Uju's pregnancy came like a sudden sound in a still night. She arrived at the flat wearing a sequined bubu that caught the light, glistening like a flowing celestial presence, and said that she wanted to tell Ifemelu's parents about it before they heard the gossip.
Adimime, she said simply.
Ifemelu's mother burst into tears, loud dramatic cries, looking around as though she could see lying around her the splintered pieces of her own story.
My God, why have you forsaken me?
I did not plan this. It happened, Auntie Uju said. I fell pregnant for Olujimi in university. I had an abortion and I'm not doing it again.
The word abortion, blunt as it was, scarred the room, because they all knew that what Ifemelu's mother did not say was that surely there were ways to take care of this. Ifemelu's father put his book down and picked it up again. He cleared his throat. He soothed his wife.
Well, I cannot ask about the man's intentions,
he said finally to Auntie Uju,
so I should ask what your own intentions are.
I will have the baby.
He waited to hear more, but Auntie Uju said nothing else, and so he sat back, assailed.
You are an adult. This is not what I hope for you, Obian Uju, but you are an adult.
Auntie Uju went over and sat on the arm of his sofa. She spoke in a low, pacifying voice, stranger for being formal, but saved from falseness by the soberness of her face.
Brother, this is not what I hope for myself either. But it has happened. I am sorry to disappoint you, after everything you have done for me, and I beg you to forgive me, but I will make the best of the situation. The general is a responsible man. He will take care of his child.
Ifemelu's father shrugged wordlessly. Auntie Uju put an arm around him, as though it were he who needed comforting. Later, Ifemelu would think of the pregnancy as symbolic. It marked the beginning of the end and made everything else seem rapid, the months rushing past, time hurtling forward. There was Auntie Uju, dimpled with exuberance, her face aglow, her mind busy with plans as her belly curved outwards. Every few days, she came up with a new girl's name for the baby.
Oga is happy, she said. He is happy to know that he can still score a goal at his age, old man like him.
The general came more often, even on some weekends, bringing her hot water bottles, herbal pills, things he had heard were good for pregnancy. He told her,
Of course you will deliver abroad,
and asked which she preferred, America or England. He wanted England so that he could travel with her. The Americans had barred entry to high-ranking members of the military government, but Auntie Uju chose America because her baby could still have automatic citizenship there. The plans were made, a hospital picked, a furnished condo rented in Atlanta.
What is a condo anyway? Ifemelu asked, and Auntie Uju shrugged and said, Who knows what Americans mean?
You should ask Obinze. He will know. At least it is a place to live, and Oga has people there who will help me.
Auntie Uju was dampened only when her driver told her that the general's wife had heard about the pregnancy and was furious. There had apparently been a tense family meeting with his relatives and hers. The general hardly spoke about his wife, but Auntie Uju knew enough. A lawyer who had given up working to raise their four children in Abuja, a woman who looked portly and pleasant in newspaper photographs.
I wonder what she's thinking, Auntie Uju said sadly, musingly.
While she was in America, the general had one of the bedrooms repainted a brilliant white. He bought a cot, its legs like delicate candles. He bought stuffed toys and too many teddy bears. Yin Yang propped them in the cot, lined some up on a shelf, and perhaps because she thought nobody would notice, she took one teddy bear to her room in the back. Auntie Uju had a boy. She sounded high and elated over the phone.
Ifem, he has so much hair. Can you imagine? What a waste!
She called him Dike, after her father, and gave him her surname, which left Ifemelu's mother agitated and sour.
The baby should have his father's name, or is the man planning to deny his child?
Ifemelu's mother asked, as they sat in their living room, still digesting the news of the birth. Auntie Uju said it was just easier to give him her name, Ifemelu said.
And is he behaving like a man that will deny his child?
Auntie said he's even talking about coming to pay her bride price.
God forbid,
Ifemelu's mother said, almost spitting the words out. And Ifemelu thought of all the fervent prayers for Auntie Uju's mentor. Her mother, when Auntie Uju came back, stayed in Dolphin Estate for a while, bathing and feeding the gurgling, smooth-skinned baby. But she faced the general with a cold officiousness. She answered him in monosyllables, as though he had betrayed her by breaking the rules of her pretense. A relationship with Auntie Uju was acceptable, but such flagrant proof of the relationship was not. The house smelled of baby powder. Auntie Uju was happy. The general held Dike often, suggesting that perhaps he needed to be fed again, or that a doctor needed to see the rash on his neck. For Dike's first birthday party, the general brought a live band. They set up in the front garden, near the generator house, and stayed until the last guests left, all of them slow and sated, taking food wrapped in foil. Auntie Uju's friends came, and the general's friends came too, their expressions determined, as though to say that no matter the circumstances, their friend's child was their friend's child. Dike, newly walking, tottered around in a suit and red bow tie, while Auntie Uju followed him, trying to get him to be still for a few moments with the photographer. Finally, tired, he began to cry, yanking at his bow tie, and the general picked him up and carried him around. It was the image of the general that would endure in Ifemelu's mind. Dike's arms around his neck, his face lit up, his front teeth jutting out as he smiled, saying,
He looks like me, but thank God he took his mother's teeth.
The general died the next week, in a military plane crash.
On the same day, the very same day that the photographer brought the pictures from Dike's birthday.
Auntie Uju would often say, in telling the story, as though this held some particular significance.
It was a Saturday afternoon. Obinze and Ifemelu were in the TV room. Inyang was upstairs with Dike. Auntie Uju was in the kitchen with Chikodili. When the phone rang, Ifemelu picked it up. The voice on the other end, the general's ADC, crackled through a bad connection, but was still clear enough to give her details. The crash happened a few miles outside Jos. The bodies were charred. There were already rumors that the head of state had engineered it to get rid of officers who he feared were planning a coup. Ifemelu held the phone too tightly, stunned. Obinze went with her to the kitchen and stood by Auntie Uju as Ifemelu repeated the ADC's words.
"You are lying,"
Auntie Uju said.
"It is a lie."
She marched towards the phone, as though to challenge it too. And then she slid to the floor, a boneless, bereft sliding, and began to weep. Ifemelu held her, cradled her, all of them unsure of what to do. And the silence in between her sobs seemed too silent. Inyang brought Dike downstairs.
"Mama,"
Dike said, looking puzzled.
"Take Dike upstairs," Obinze told Inyang.
There was banging on the gate. Two men and three women, relatives of the general, had bullied Adamu to open the gate, and now stood at the front door shouting,
"Uju, pack your things and get out now. Give us the khakis."
One of the women was skeletal, agitated and red-eyed, and as she shouted,
"Common harlot, God forbid that you will touch our brother's property. Prostitute, you will never live in peace in this Lagos."
She pulled her headscarf from her head and tied it tightly around her waist in preparation for a fight. At first, Auntie Uju said nothing, staring at them, standing still at the door. Then she asked them to leave in a voice hoarse from tears, but the relative's shouting intensified, and so Auntie Uju turned to go back indoors.
"Okay, don't go," she said. "Just stay there. Stay there while I go and call my boys from the army barracks."
Only then did they leave, telling her,
"We are coming back with our own boys."
Only then did Auntie Uju begin to sob again.
"I have nothing. Everything is in his name. Where will I take my son to now?"
She picked up the phone from its cradle and then stared at it, uncertain whom to call.
"Call Uche and Adesua," Ifemelu said. "They would know what to do."
Auntie Uju did, pressing the speaker button, and then leaned against the wall.
"You have to leave immediately. Make sure you clear the house. Take everything," Uche said. "Do it fast, fast before his people come back. Arrange a tow van and take the generator. Make sure you take the generator."
"I don't know where to find a van,"
Auntie Uju mumbled, with a helplessness foreign to her.
"We are going to arrange one for you, fast, fast. You have to take that generator. That is what will pay for your life until you gather yourself. You have to go somewhere for a while, so that they don't give you trouble. Go to London or America. Do you have American visa?"
"Yes."
Ifemelu would remember the final moments in a blur. Adamu saying there was a journalist from City People at the gate. Ifemelu and Chikodili stuffing clothes in suitcases. Obinze carrying things out to the van. Dike stumbling around and chortling. The rooms upstairs had grown unbearably hot. The air conditioners had suddenly stopped working, as though they had decided in unison to pay tribute to the end.
Chapter 7
Obinze wanted to go to the University of Ibadan because of a poem. He read the poem to her, J.P. Clark's Ibadan, and he lingered on the words, "Running splash of rust and gold."
"Are you serious?" she asked him. "Because of this poem?" "It's so beautiful."
Ifemelu shook her head in mocking exaggerated incredulity. But she too wanted to go to Ibadan, because Auntie Uju had gone there. They filled out their JAM forms together, sitting at the dining table while his mother hovered around saying,
"Are you using the right pencil? Cross-check everything. I have heard of the most unlikely mistakes that you will not believe."
Obinze said, "Mummy,
We are more likely to fill it out without mistakes if you stop talking.
At least you should make Nsoka your second choice,
his mother said. But Obinze did not want to go to Nsoka. He wanted to escape the life he had always had, and Nsoka, to Ifemelu, seemed remote and dusty. And so they both agreed to make the University of Lagos their second choice. The next day, Obinze's mother collapsed in the library. A student found her spread on the floor like a rag, a small bump on her head, and Obinze told Ifemelu,
"Thank God we haven't submitted our JAM forms."
"What do you mean?"
"My mom is returning to Nsoka at the end of this session. I have to be near her. The doctor said this thing will keep happening."
He paused.
"We can see each other during long weekends. I will come to Ibadan and you come to Nsoka."
"You're a joker," she told him. "Biko, I'm changing to Nsoka as well." The change pleased her father. It was heartening, he said, that she would go to university in Iboland, since she had lived her whole life in the West. Her mother was downcast. Ibadan was only an hour away, but Nsoka meant a day's journey on the bus.
"It's not a day, Mummy, just 7 hours," Ifemelu said.
"And what is the difference between that and the day?" her mother asked.
Ifemelu was looking forward to being away from home, to the independence of owning her own time, and she felt comforted that Ranyanudo and Tochi were going to Nsoka too. So was Emenike, who asked Obinze if they could be roommates in the boys' quarters of Obinze's house. Obinze said yes. Ifemelu wished he had not.
"There's just something about Emenike," she said. "But anyway, as long as he goes away when we are busy with sealing."
Later, Obinze would ask half seriously if Ifemelu thought his mother's fainting had been deliberate, a plot to keep him close. For a long time he spoke wistfully of Ibadan, until he visited the campus for a table tennis tournament and returned to tell her sheepishly, "Ibadan reminded me of Nsoka." To go to Nsoka was to finally see Obinze's home, a bungalow resting in a compound filled with flowers. Ifemelu imagined him growing up, riding his bike down the sloping street, returning home from primary school with his bag and water bottle. Still, Nsoka disoriented her. She thought it too slow, the dust too red, the people too satisfied with the smallness of their lives. But she would come to love it. A hesitant love at first. From the window of her hostel room, where four beds were squashed into a space for two, she could look out to the entrance of Bello Hall. Tall melina trees swayed in the wind, and underneath them were hawkers, guarding trays of bananas and groundnuts, and okadas all parked close to each other, the motorcyclists talking and laughing, but each of them alert to customers. She put up bright blue wallpaper in her corner, and because she had heard stories of roommate squabbles, one final year student, it was said, had poured kerosene into the drawer of the first year student for being what was called saucy. She felt fortunate about her roommates. They were easygoing, and soon she was sharing with them and borrowing from them the things that easily ran out: toothpaste and powdered milk, and ndomi noodles, and hair pomade. Most mornings, she woke up to the rumbling murmur of voices in the corridor, the Catholic students saying the rosary, and she would hurry to the bathroom to collect water in her bucket before the tap stopped, to squat over the toilet before it became unbearably full. Sometimes when she was too late, and the toilets already swirled with maggots, she would go to Obinze's house, even if he was not there, and once the house help Augustina opened the front door, she would say, "Tina, Tina, how now? I came to use the toilet." She often ate lunch in Obinze's house, or they would go to town, to Onyeka Ozulu, and sit on wooden benches in the dimness of the restaurant, eating on enamel plates the tenderest of meats and the tastiest of stews. She spent some nights in Obinze's boys' quarters, lounging on his mattress on the floor, listening to music. Sometimes she would dance in her underwear, wiggling her hips, while he teased her about having a small bottom.
"I was going to say, shake it, but there's nothing to shake."
University was bigger and baggier. There was room to hide, so much room. She did not feel as though she did not belong, because there were many options for belonging.
Obinze teased her about how popular she already was, her room busy during the first-year rush, final-year boys dropping by, eager to try their luck, even though a large photo of Obinze hung above her pillow. The boys amused her. They came and sat on her bed and solemnly offered to show her around campus. And she imagined them saying the same words in the same tone to the first-year girl in the next room. One of them, though, was different. His name was Odian. He came to her room not as part of the first-year rush, but to talk to her roommates about the students' union. And after that, he would come by to visit her, to say hello, sometimes bringing a pack of suya, hot and spicy, wrapped in oil-stained newspaper. His activism surprised Ifemelu. He seemed a little too urbane, a little too cool to be in the students' union government, but also impressed her. He had thick, perfectly shaped lips, the lower the same size as the upper, lips that were both thoughtful and sensual, and as he spoke,
"If the students are not united, nobody will listen to us."
Ifemelu imagined kissing him, in a way that she imagined doing something she knew she never would. It was because of him that she joined the demonstration and convinced Obinze to join too. They chanted, "No light, no water," and "Visi is a goat," and found themselves carried along with a roaring crowd that settled finally in front of the vice-chancellor's house. Bottles were broken, a car was set on fire, and then the vice-chancellor came out, diminutive, encased between security men, and spoke in pastoral tones. Later, Obinze's mother said,
"I understand the students' grievances, but we are not the enemy. The military is the enemy. They have not paid our salary in months. How can we teach if we cannot eat?"
And still later, the news spread around campus of a strike by lecturers, and students gathered in the hostel foyer, bristling with the known and the unknown. It was true, the hall rep confirmed the news, and they all sighed, contemplating this sudden, unwanted break, and returned to their rooms to pack. The hostel would be closed the next day. Ifemelu heard a girl close by say,
"I don't have 10 kobo for transport to go home."
The strike lasted too long. The weeks crawled past. Ifemelu was restless, antsy. Every day she listened to the news, hoping to hear that the strike was over. Obinze called her at Ranyanudo's house. She would arrive minutes before he was due to call and sit by the grey rotary phone, waiting for it to ring. She felt cut away from him, each of them living and breathing in separate spheres. He bored and spiritless in Soka, she bored and spiritless in Lagos, and everything curdled in lethargy. Life had become a turgid and suspended film. Her mother asked if she wanted to join the sewing class at church to keep her occupied, and her father said that this, the unending university strike, was why young people became armed robbers. The strike was nationwide, and all her friends were home. Even Kayode was home, back on holiday from his American university. She visited friends and went to parties, wishing Obinze lived in Lagos. Sometimes, Odien, who had a car, would pick her up and take her where she needed to go.
"That your boyfriend is lucky," he told her,
and she laughed, flirting with him. She still imagined kissing him, slow-eyed and thick-lipped Odien. One weekend, Obinze visited and stayed with Kayode.
"What is going on with this Odien?"
Obinze asked her.
"What?"
"Kayode said he took you home after Osahan's party. You didn't tell me."
"I forgot."
"You forgot?
I told you he picked me up the other day, didn't I?"
"Ifem, what is going on?"
She sighed.
"Ceiling. It's nothing. I'm just curious about him. Nothing's ever going to happen, but I am curious. You get curious about other girls, don't you?"
He looked at her, his eyes fearful.
"No,"
he said coldly.
"I don't."
"Be honest."
"I am being honest. The problem is you think everyone is like you. You think you're the norm, but you're not."
"What do you mean?"
"Nothing, just forget it."
He did not want to talk about it any further, but the air between them was marred, and remained disturbed for days, even after he went back home, so that when the strike ended...
"The lecturers have called it off, praise God!"
Chitachi shouted from their flat one morning, and Ifemelu returned to Nsoka. They were tentative with each other for the first few days, their conversations on tiptoe, their hugs abridged. It surprised Ifemelu how much she had missed Nsoka itself, the routines of unhurried pace, friends gathered in her room until past midnight, the inconsequential gossip told and retold, the stairs climbed slowly up and down as though in a gradual awakening, and each morning whitened by the harmattan. In Lagos, the harmattan was a mere veil of haze, but in Nsoka it was a raging mercurial presence. The mornings were crisp, the afternoons ashen with heat, and the nights unknown. Dust whirls would start in the far distance, very pretty to look at as long as they were far away, and swirl until they coated everything brown, even eyelashes. Everywhere, moisture would be greedily sucked up. The wooden laminate on tables would peel off and curl. Pages of exercise books would crackle. Clothes would dry minutes after being hung out. Lips would crack and bleed, and rob and mentholatum kept within reach, in pockets and handbags. Skin would be shined with Vaseline, while the forgotten bits, between the fingers or at the elbows, turned a dull ash. The tree branches would be stark, and with their leaves fallen, were a kind of proud desolation. The church bazaars would leave the air redolent, smoky from mass cooking. Some nights the heat lay thick like a towel. Other nights a sharp cold wind would descend, and Ifemelu would abandon her hostel room, and snuggled next to Obinze on his mattress, listen to the whistling pines howling outside, in a world suddenly fragile and breakable. Obinze's muscles were aching. He lay on his belly, and Ifemelu straddled him, massaging his back and neck and thighs with her fingers, her knuckles, her elbows. He was painfully taut. She stood on him, placed one foot gingerly on the back of a thigh, and then the other. "Does it feel okay?"
"Yes,"
he groaned in pleasure pain. She pressed down slowly, his skin warm under the soles of her feet, his tense muscles unknotting. She steadied herself with a hand on the wall and dug her heels deeper, moving inch by inch while he grunted.
"Ah, Fem, yes, just there, ah!"
"You should stretch after playing ball, Mr. Man," she said.
And then she was lying on his back, tickling his underarms and kissing his neck.
"I have a suggestion for a better kind of massage," he said.
When he undressed her, he did not stop as usual at her underwear. He pulled it down, and she raised her legs to aid him. "Ceiling," she said, half certain. She did not want him to stop, but she had imagined this differently, assumed they would make a carefully planned ceremony of it.
"I'll come out," he said. "You know it doesn't always work. If it doesn't work, then we'll welcome Junior."
"Stop it." He looked up.
"But Ifem, we're going to get married anyway."
"Look at you. I might meet a rich, handsome man and leave you."
"Impossible. We'll go to America when we graduate and raise our fine children."
"You'll say anything now because your brain is between your legs."
"But my brain is always there."
They were both laughing, and then the laughter stilled, gave way to a new strange graveness, a slippery joining. It felt to Ifemelu like a weak copy, a floundering imitation of what she had imagined it would be. After he pulled away, jerking and gasping and holding himself, a discomfort nagged at her. She had been tense through it all, unable to relax. She had imagined his mother watching them. The image had forced itself onto her mind, and it had, even more oddly, been a double image, of his mother and Onyegon Wenu, both watching them with unblinking eyes. She knew she could not possibly tell Obinze's mother what had happened, even though she had promised to, and had believed then that she would. But now she could not see how. What would she say? What words would she use? Would Obinze's mother expect details? She and Obinze should have planned it better. That way she would know how to tell his mother. The unplannedness of it all had left her a little shaken, and also a little disappointed. It seemed somehow as though it had not been worth it after all. When a week or so later she woke up in pain, a sharp stinging on her side and a great sickening nausea pervading her body, she panicked. Then she vomited, and her panic grew. "It's happened," she told Obinze. "I'm pregnant." They had met as usual in front of the Egbo refectory after their morning lecture. Students milled around. A group of boys were smoking and laughing close by, and for a moment their laughter seemed directed at her. Obinze's brows wrinkled. He did not seem to understand what she was saying. "But, Ifem, it can't be. It's too early. Besides, I came out." "I told you it doesn't work," she said. He suddenly seemed young, a confused small boy looking helplessly at her. Her panic grew. On an impulse, she held a passing Okada and jumped on the back and told the motorcyclist that she was going to town.
"Ifem, what are you doing?" Obinze asked. "Where are you going?" "To call Auntie Uju," she said.
Obinze got on the next Okada and was soon speeding behind her, past the university gates and to the Nitel office, where Ifemelu gave the man behind the peeling counter a piece of paper with Auntie Uju's American number. On the phone, she spoke in code, making it up as she went along, because of the people standing there, some waiting to make their own calls, others merely loitering, but all listening, with unabashed and open interest, to the conversations of others.
"Auntie, I think what happened to you before DK came has happened to me," Ifemelu said. "We ate the food a week ago."
"Just last week? How many times?"
"Once."
"Ifem, calm down. I don't think you're pregnant. But you need to do a test. Don't go to the campus medical center. Go to town, where nobody will know you. But calm down first. It will be okay, Inugo."
Later, Ifemelu sat on a rickety chair in the waiting room of the lab, stony and silent, ignoring Obinze. She was angry with him. It was unfair, she knew, but she was angry with him. As she went into the dirty toilet with a small container the lab girl had given her, he asked, already getting up, "Should I come with you?" And she snapped,
"Come with me for what?"
And she wanted to slap the lab girl, a yellow-faced beanpole of a girl who sneered and shook her head when Ifemelu first said, "Pregnancy test," as though she could not believe she was encountering one more case of immorality. Now she was watching them, smirking and humming insouciantly.
"I have the result," she said after a while,
holding the unsealed paper, her expression disappointed because it was negative. Ifemelu was too stunned at first to be relieved, and then she needed to urinate again.
"People should respect themselves and live like Christians, to avoid trouble," the lab girl said as they left.
That evening, Ifemelu vomited again. She was in Obinze's room, lying down and reading, still frosty towards him, when a rush of salty saliva filled her mouth and she leapt up and ran to the toilet.
"It must be something I ate," she said. "That yam pottage I bought from Mama Oweri."
Obinze went inside the main house and came back to say his mother was taking her to the doctor's. It was late evening. His mother did not like the young doctor who was on call at the medical center in the evenings, and so she drove to Dr. Achufusi's house. As they passed the primary school with its trimmed hedges of whistling pine, Ifemelu suddenly imagined that she was indeed pregnant, and the girl had used expired test chemicals in that dingy lab. She blurted out,
"We had sex, Auntie. Once."
She felt Obinze tense. His mother looked at her in the rearview mirror.
"Let us see the doctor first," she said.
Dr. Achufusi, an avuncular and pleasant man, pressed at Ifemelu's side and announced,
"It's your appendix, very inflamed. We should get it out quickly."
He turned to Obinze's mother.
"I can schedule her for tomorrow afternoon."
"Thank you so much, doctor," Obinze's mother said. In the car, Ifemelu said,
I've never had surgery, Auntie.
It's nothing, Ubinze's mother said briskly. Our doctors here are very good. Get in touch with your parents and tell them not to worry. We will take care of you. After they discharge you, you can stay in the house until you feel strong.
Ifemelu called her mother's colleague, Auntie Bunmi, and gave her a message, as well as Obinze's home phone number, to pass on to her mother. That evening her mother called. She sounded short of breath.
God, he's in control, my precious,
her mother said.
Thank God for this, your friend. God will bless her and her mother.
It's him, a boy.
Oh,
her mother paused.
Please thank them. God bless them. We will take the first bus tomorrow morning to Nsoka.
Ifemelu remembered a nurse cheerfully shaving her pubic hair, the rough scratch of the razor blade, the smell of antiseptic. Then there was a blankness, an erasure of her mind, and when she emerged from it, groggy and still swaying on the edge of memory, she heard her parents talking to Obinze's mother. Her mother was holding her hand. Later, Obinze's mother would ask them to stay in her house. There was no point wasting money on a hotel.
Ifemelu is like a daughter to me, she said.
Before they returned to Lagos, her father said with that intimidated awe he had in the face of the well-educated,
she has B.A. London first class.
And her mother said, very respectful boy, that Obinze. He has good home training, and their hometown is not far from us. Obinze's mother waited a few days, perhaps for Ifemelu to regain her strength, before she called them and asked them to sit down and turn the TV off.
Obinze and Ifemelu, people make mistakes, but some mistakes can be avoided.
Obinze remained silent. Ifemelu said, yes, Auntie.
You must always use a condom. If you want to be irresponsible, then wait until you are no longer in my care.
Her tone had hardened, become censorious.
If you make the choice to be sexually active, then you must make the choice to protect yourself. Obinze, you should take your pocket money and buy condoms. Ifemelu, you too. It is not my concern if you are embarrassed. You should go into the pharmacy and buy them. You should never ever let the boy be in charge of your own protection. If he does not want to use it, then he does not care enough about you, and you should not be there.
Obinze, you may not be the person who will get pregnant, but if it happens, it will change your entire life, and you cannot undo it. And please, both of you, keep it between both of you. Diseases are everywhere. AIDS is real.
They were silent.
Did you hear me?
Obinze's mother asked.
Yes, Auntie, Ifemelu said. Obinze,
his mother said.
Mummy, I've heard you,
Obinze said, adding sharply, I'm not a small boy.
Then he got up and stalked out of the room. Chapter 8. Strikes now were common. In the newspapers, university lecturers listed their complaints, the agreements that were trampled in the dust by government men whose own children were schooling abroad. Campuses were emptied, classrooms drained of life. Students hoped for short strikes, because they could not hope to have no strike at all. Everyone was talking about leaving. Even Emenike had left for England. Nobody knew how he managed to get a visa.
So, he didn't even tell you? Ifemelu asked Obinze. And Obinze said, you know how Emenike is.
Ranya Nudo, who had a cousin in America, applied for a visa, but was rejected at the embassy by a black American, who she said had a cold and was more interested in blowing his nose than in looking at her documents. Sister Ibenabo started the Student Visa Miracle Vigil on Fridays, a gathering of young people, each one holding out an envelope with a visa application form, on which Sister Ibenabo laid a hand of blessing. One girl, already in her final year at the University of Ife, got an American visa the first time she tried, and gave a tearful, excited testimony in church.
Even if I have to start from the beginning in America, at least I know when I will graduate, she said.
One day, Auntie Uju called. She no longer called frequently, Before, she would call Ranyanudo's house if Ifemelu was in Lagos, or Obinze's house if Ifemelu was at school. But her calls had dried up. She was working three jobs, not yet qualified practice medicine in America. She talked about the exam she had to take. Various steps mean various things that Ifemelu did not understand. Whenever Ifemelu's mother suggested asking Auntie Uju to send them something from America, multivitamin shoes, Ifemelu's father would say no. They had to let Uju find her feet first. And her mother would say, a hint of slyness in her smile, that 4 years was long enough to find one's feet.
Ifem, ke do?
Auntie Uju asked. I thought you would be in Soka. I just called Obinze's house. We're on strike.
The strike hasn't ended.
No, that last one ended. We went back to school and then they started another one.
What is this kind of nonsense?
Auntie Uju said, honestly, you should come and study here. I'm sure you can easily get a scholarship. And you can help me take care of DK.
I'm telling you, the small money I make is all going to his babysitter. And by God's grace, by the time you come, I will have passed all my exams and started my residency.
Auntie Uju sounded enthusiastic but vague. Until she voiced it, she had not given the idea much thought. Ifemelu might have left at that. A formless idea floated but allowed to sink again, if not for Obinze.
You should do it, Ifem, he said. You have nothing to lose. Take the SATs and try for a scholarship. Gineya can help you apply to schools. And Uju is there, so at least you have foundation to start with.
I wish I could do the same, but I can't just get up and go. It's better for me to finish my first degree and then come to America for graduate school. International students can get funding, financial aid for graduate school. Ifemelu didn't quite grasp what it all meant, but it sounded correct because it came from him, the America expert, who so easily said graduate school instead of postgraduate school. And so she began to dream. She saw herself in a house from the Cosby Show, in a school with students holding notebooks miraculously free of wear and crease. She took the SATs at a Lagos center, packed with thousands of people, all bristling with their own American ambitions. Ginnika, who had just graduated from college, applied to schools on her behalf, calling to say,
I just wanted you to know I'm focusing on the Philadelphia area, because I went here.
Although Ifemelu knew where Philadelphia was, to her, America was America. The strike ended. Ifemelu returned to Nsoka, eased back into campus life, and from time to time, she dreamed of America. When Auntie Uju called to say that there were acceptance letters and a scholarship offer, she stopped dreaming. She was too afraid to hope, now that it seemed possible. Make small braids that will last long. It's very expensive to make hair here, Auntie Uju told her.
Auntie, let me get the visa first,
Ifemelu said. She applied for a visa, convinced that a rude American would reject her application. It was what happened so often, after all. But the grey-haired woman wearing a St. Vincent de Paul pin on her lapel smiled at her and said, Pick up your visa in 2 days. Good luck with your studies. On the afternoon that she picked up her passport, the pale-toned visa on the second page, she organized that triumphant ritual that signaled the start of a new life overseas, the division of personal property among friends. Ranyanudo, Priye, and Tochi were in her bedroom drinking coke, her clothes in a pile on the bed, and the first thing they all reached for was her orange dress, her favorite dress, a gift from Auntie Uju. The A-line flare and neck-to-hem zipper had always made her feel both glamorous and dangerous.
It makes things easy for me,
Obinze would say, before he slowly began to unzip it. She wanted to keep the dress, but Ranyanudo said,
Ifem, you know you'll have any kind of dress you want in America. And next time we see you, you will be a serious Americana.
Her mother said Jesus told her in a dream that Ifemelu would prosper in America. Her father pressed a slender envelope into her hand, saying,
I wish I had more.
And he realized with sadness that he must have borrowed it. In the face of the enthusiasm of others, she suddenly felt flaccid and afraid.
Maybe I should stay and finish here, she told Obinze. Ifem, no, you should go. Besides, you don't even like geology. You can study something else in America.
But the scholarship is partial. Where will I find the money to pay the balance? I can't work with a student visa.
You can do work-study at school. You'll find a way. 75% of your tuition is a big deal.
She nodded, riding the wave of his faith. She visited his mother to say goodbye.
Nigeria is chasing away its best resources, Obinze's mother said resignedly, hugging her.
Auntie, I will miss you. Thank you so much for everything.
Stay well, my dear, and do well. Write to us. Make sure you keep in touch.
Ifemelu nodded, tearful. As she left, already parting the curtain at the front door, Obinze's mother said,
And make sure you and Obinze have a plan. Have a plan.
Her words, so unexpected and so right, lifted Ifemelu's spirits. Their plan became this. He would come to America the minute he graduated. He would find a way to get a visa. Perhaps by then, she would be able to help with his visa. In the following years, even after she was no longer in touch with him, she would sometimes remember his mother's words.
Make sure you and Obinze have a plan.
And feel comforted.
Chapter 9
Mariama returned carrying old-stained brown paper bags from the Chinese restaurant, trailing the smells of grease and spice into the stuffy salon.
The film finished?
She glanced at the blank TV screen and then flipped through the pile of DVDs to select another.
Excuse me? Please to eat,
Aisha said to Ifemelu. She perched on a chair at the back and ate fried chicken wings with her fingers, her eyes on the TV screen. The new film began with trailers, jaggedly cut scenes interspersed with flashes of light. Each ended with a male Nigerian voice, theatrical and loud, saying,
Grab your copy now!
Mariama ate standing up. She said something to Halima.
I finish first and eat,
Halima replied in English.
You can go ahead and eat if you want to,
Halima's customer said, a young woman with a high voice and a pleasant manner.
No, I finish just small more,
Halima said. Her customer's head had only a tuft of hair left in front, sticking up like animal fur, while the rest was done in neat micro braids that fell to her neck.
I have an hour before I have to go pick up my daughters,
the customer said.
How many you have?
Halima asked.
Two,
the customer said. She looked about 17.
Two beautiful girls.
The new film had started. The grinning face of a middle-aged actress filled the screen.
Oh, yes, I like her,
Halima said.
Patience, she don't take any nonsense.
You know her?
Mariama asked Ifemelu, pointing at the TV screen. No, Ifemelu said. Why did they insist on asking if she knew Nollywood actors? The entire room smelled too strongly of food. It made the stuffy air rank with oiliness, and yet it also made her slightly hungry. She ate some of her carrots. Halima's customer tilted her head this way and that in front of the mirror and said,
Thank you so much. It's gorgeous.
After she left, Mariama said,
Very small girl, and already she has two children.
Oh, these people,
Halima said.
When a girl is 13, already she knows all the positions. Never in Afrique.
Never,
Mariama agreed. They looked at Ifemelu for her agreement, her approval. They expected it, in this shared space of their Africanness. But Ifemelu said nothing and turned a page of her novel. They would, she was sure, talk about her after she left. That Nigerian girl, she feels very important because of Princeton. Look at her food bar. She does not eat real food anymore. They would laugh with derision, but only a mild derision because she was still their African sister, even if she had briefly lost her way. A new smell of oiliness flooded the room when Halima opened her plastic container of food. She was eating and talking to the television screen.
Oh, stupid man, she will take your money.
Ifemelu brushed away at some sticky hair on her neck. The room was seething with heat.
Can we leave the door open? She asked.
Mariama opened the door, propped it with a chair.
This heat is really bad.
Each heat wave reminded Ifemelu of her first. the summer she arrived. It was summer in America. She knew this, but all her life she had thought of overseas as a cold place of wool coats and snow, and because America was overseas, and her illusions so strong they could not be fended off by reason, she bought the thickest sweater she could find in Tejosho Market for her trip. She wore it for the journey, zipping it all the way up in the humming interior of the plane, and then unzipping it as she left the airport building with Auntie Uju. The sweltering heat alarmed her, as did Auntie Uju's old Toyota hatchback, with a patch of rust on its side and peeling fabric on the seats. She stared at buildings and cars and signboards, all of them matte, disappointingly matte. In the landscape of her imagination, the mundane things in America were covered in a high shine gloss. She was startled, most of all, by the teenage boy in a baseball cap, standing near a brick wall, face down, body leaning forward, hands between his legs. She turned to look again.
"See that boy?" she said. "I didn't know people do things like this in America."
"You didn't know people pee in America?"
Auntie Uju asked, barely glancing at the boy before turning back to a traffic light.
"Ah, Auntie, I mean that they do it outside, like that."
"They don't. It's not like back home where everybody does it. He can get arrested for that. But this is not a good neighborhood anyway," Auntie Uju said shortly.
There was something different about her. Ifemelu had noticed it right away at the airport. Her roughly braided hair, her ears bereft of earrings, her quick casual hug, as if it had been weeks rather than years since they had last seen each other.
"I'm supposed to be with my books now," Auntie Uju said, eyes focused on the road. "You know my exam is coming."
Ifemelu had not known that there was yet another exam. She had thought Auntie Uju was waiting for a result, but she said, "Yes, I know." Their silence was full of stones. Ifemelu felt like apologizing, although she was not quite sure what she would be apologizing for. Perhaps Auntie Uju regretted her presence now that she was here, in Auntie Uju's wheezing car. Auntie Uju's cell phone rang.
"Yes, this is Uju."
She pronounced it Uju instead of Uju.
"Is that how you pronounce your name now?"
Ifemelu asked afterwards.
"It's what they call me."
Ifemelu swallowed the words. "Well, that isn't your name." Instead, she said in Igbo,
"I did not know it would be so hot here." "We have a heat wave, the first one this summer,"
Auntie Uju said, as though heat wave was something Ifemelu was supposed to understand. She had never felt a heat quite so hot, an enveloping, uncompassionate heat. Auntie Uju's door handle, when they arrived at her one-bedroom apartment, was warm to the touch. Dike sprang up from the carpeted floor of the living room, scattered with toy cars and action figures, and hugged her as though he remembered her.
"Alma, this is my cousin,"
he said to his babysitter, a pale-skinned, tired-faced woman with black hair held in a greasy ponytail. If Ifemelu had met Alma in Lagos, she would have thought of her as white, but she would learn that Alma was Hispanic, an American category that was confusingly both an ethnicity and a race. And she would remember Alma when, years later, she wrote a blog post titled, "Understanding America for the Non-American Black, What Hispanic Means." Hispanic means the frequent companions of American blacks in poverty rankings. Hispanic means a slight step above American blacks in the American race ladder. Hispanic means the chocolate-skinned woman from Peru. Hispanic means the indigenous people of Mexico. Hispanic means the biracial-looking folks from the Dominican Republic. Hispanic means the paler folks from Puerto Rico. Hispanic also means the blonde, blue-eyed guy from Argentina. All you need to be is Spanish-speaking, but not from Spain, and voila, you're a race called Hispanic. But that afternoon, she hardly noticed Alma, or the living room furnished only with a couch and a TV, or the bicycle lodged in a corner, because she was absorbed by Dike. The last time she saw him, on the day of Auntie Uju's hasty departure from Lagos, he had been a one-year-old, crying unendingly at the airport as though he understood the upheaval his life had just undergone. And now here he was, a first grader with a seamless American accent and a hyper-happiness about him,
the kind of child who could never stay still and who never seemed sad.
Why do you have a sweater? It's too hot for a sweater.